It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, from about 1960 to 1990, the era is sometimes called a golden age for serial killers, with hundreds of new active killers each decade. We talked to an investigative historian about why that happened and why serial killers are way less common today. First, new data from federal courts show that the number of farmers seeking Chapter 12 bankruptcy protection reached its highest point in a decade last year. While 2008's recession had a big impact on farms back then, a host of factors pushed farmers to seek bankruptcy even in better economic times. Wisconsin farmers in particular are bearing the brunt of low commodity prices and an ongoing international trade dispute, which is impacting their operations and finances. Our next guest is here to talk about the issues facing Wisconsin farmers and potential solutions. Mike North is the president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back with you.
Well, we have this news about bankruptcy filings last year. We're just hearing in the news today an increase in the default rate on farm loans. What do you make of these numbers, Mike?
Well, it's been a trend that's been in place for the last several years, especially as you look at western Wisconsin. Lots of pressure in our state, obviously, because of the presence of the dairy industry. The dairy industry has felt the brunt of low commodity prices more than really any sector has across the spectrum of agriculture. And as we observe here in Wisconsin, the impacts of that, it has led largely to this increase of bankruptcies versus some other states. So there was some data that came out of Ohio State not too long ago that showed that the number of bankruptcies here in Wisconsin were more than double of the next closest state. Nebraska had 17, Minnesota had 9, New York had 15. Wisconsin really truly stands out, and I think it's largely a function of the presence, the denser populace of dairy farmers in our state versus some of the surrounding states.
We'll dig more into that in just a bit. I want to talk about what it means to file for bankruptcy. It doesn't, for farmers or any other business operation, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going out of business. What does a Chapter 12 bankruptcy filing mean?
Well, I'm no banker, but a lot of times when you go through this process, you have the opportunity to reorganize your business in a way where you're securing the debts that are attached to the operation. There are some unsecured creditors that obviously have exposure in that process, and frankly, it allows you to come back out of some of that debt burden and back into your operation without the challenges that the debt poses in the operation prior to that point. But, you know, as it sits, you know, you're seeing a lot more of those at the onset. Guys are really trying to work it out. Let's face it, the farm crowd is not one to walk away from responsibility. And, you know, as you talk through the different processes, if they can figure out a path forward, they're going to.
And we're seeing farmers this time of year, they're looking, hopefully have already secured loans for the coming season, with some in default, some with high debts. This is a challenging time. Some of those farmers aren't getting the loans they want this time of year. Is that right?
Yeah, there's lots of those stories out there. I can tell you, I think that the storyline is bigger than what reality is, but it is for a fact it is happening. There are some farmers that are not getting their operating notes, which that is a real issue as we come into spring and farmers are securing seed and fertilizer and paying their rents and any other obligations that they have in order to get the next crop in the ground. Without that operating money, that ground is likely to be planted by somebody else this year.
Talking to Mike North, president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group, talking about increased filings for bankruptcy among farmers, especially here in Wisconsin. Mike, let's get back to that point you touched on earlier, low commodity milk prices. Can you talk about what we've seen in recent years?
So everyone likes to go back to the year 2014. At that point, we set the largest prices in history with regard to milk. At that same time, we also had very high feed costs because, as you recall, we were coming off of the 2012 drought. Feed costs were still very high. Even though they were working lower, they were, you know, much higher than they are today. So farmers went through a very interesting period in 2014 with milk prices that were at $24. In the very next calendar year, we were down to $16 and $17 prices. And in the years since, we've seen a lot of prices closer to $14 to $15, some as low as $12.76. And in that environment, the amount of profitability on the farm has not only been compressed, but in many cases been inverted. And so there's been losses experienced by dairymen for 3 and 4 years as we've moved through the last few. That takes away all of the equity gains that might have been experienced in the years that led up to this and really puts dairymen in a very difficult spot, because dairying is not an industry that you just get into and then easily get out of. You have a lot of capital expense on the front end. Cows don't just give milk today and not tomorrow. You know, it's a process of bringing, you know, calves up through their stages being heifers and into the barn as a productive cow. So it's a long-term commitment, and it's very difficult as you've gone through these last few years to look forward over the next few and ask the question, do I want to continue to make that commitment on the hope that things are going to change?
What's driving the lower milk commodity prices?
Well, we've had a number of things that have led into it. The higher prices that were experienced really in that run from 2011 through 2014 was spurred by a lot of growth in global demand. And the American farmer here in Wisconsin, of course, among our dairymen, they rose to the occasion, and supply grew to meet that new and growing demand. And then, of course, we saw a tumble in prices. Some of that can be attributed to the fact that we were coming out from under the quantitative easing that had preceded that following the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. We saw, at that point, general compression across all agricultural prices. As a result of that change in our fiscal and monetary policy, ultimately we've had supply build at a rate coming out of 2014 that grew beyond demand in a market where prices were being compressed by other forces. And now on top of that, we have an issue with trade with some of our key partners as a result of tariff. As you talk about Mexico, which is the number one buyer of product, they are not buying the processed cheese that they had before. And so we've seen barrel cheese prices at the exchange and around the country become compressed because that partner has been minimalized due to tariffs. And their response essentially to our steel and aluminum tariff was a retaliatory tariff on U.S. cheese. So that will stand even with the newly constructed USMCA, which replaces the old NAFTA arrangement. Obviously, China has been in the news a lot. They have been a very big buyer of U.S. dairy products, and that is also an issue that we're trying to work through. And we all hope, again, that this can be rectified, that we will get a deal, and as we move into these next several months, we'll move back towards a normal flow of trade with those partners. But that has also helped backlog supply into our domestic market. And unfortunately, the American consumer, just because prices are cheap, they're not going to rush in and buy exponentially more product. It's not that elastic. So that is a real challenge for us as we go forward. And the only way in this environment to necessarily try to bring balance back to the market is to reduce supply. And part of what we've watched in terms of bankruptcies has started to move the conversation towards finding that balance, but it's a very unfortunate path to have to take to strike a balance in our market.
We're talking to Mike North right now, president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. He's with us to talk about What could be contributing to the growing number of farm bankruptcies filed in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how all this works? Are you a farmer yourself who's been impacted by low commodity prices, maybe by these trade issues with places like Mexico and China? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the rise in bankruptcy filings among farmers in the Midwest, especially Wisconsin. Mike North is with us, president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer, have you been impacted by the economy, by trade and tariff issues? Have you been driven out of farming or some part of your operation? What would you like to see change when it comes to agriculture and policy? And do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hello.
Hello. I have a question about changing some of the laws in Wisconsin or nationwide in regards to the direct sale of milk and meat, especially for the smaller operations. You know, it becomes cost prohibitive to directly market the stuff. And, you know, a person can go into a tavern and get a shot of whiskey, but I couldn't sell a gallon of milk unpasteurized to somebody. To me, it didn't seem right. But like any ideas on changing the laws.
Tom, thanks for the call. Mike, I mean, we do see farmers, you know, selling meat and dairy products sometimes at farmers markets. Tom, they're talking about unpasteurized milk, which is a long-running controversy here in the state. Are those things that can make a difference between going into the red and going into the black for farmers?
You know, there's certainly been lots of chatter about, you know, the raw milk issue, right? You do see farm marketed products made available in a lot of local venues like farmers markets. The raw milk issue has always been a real challenge, and several bills have been introduced and put forward there. But it seems almost every time that such a bill is put forward, somewhere inside the state, there's, you know, a group of kids that got sick from a gallon of milk brought from the farm to a party, and kids just didn't have the bacterial exposure to make them able to maintain the immunity to the bacteria. Ultimately, it's been shut down many times, and you know, there's some philosophical discussions that surround that, but economically we often find that it doesn't bring enough benefit you know, to have a few sales in that regard to offset the overall condition of the farm economy.
Right, so, if you're selling hundreds of gallons of milk at very low prices, selling tens of gallons of raw milk maybe isn't going to balance that out.
That's a fact. That's a fact.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go now to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hello. For 7 years, I was a hired man, and I worked for various farmers in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So we produce milk for AMPI, Mid-America, NFO, and Land O'Lakes, various farms. And it was my experience that these milk producers would purchase milk from farmers at lower and lower cost because they, in turn, would sell the milk to cheese producers who wanted low cost for their commodity to make their cheese. So the competition was for lower prices among the cheese producers, but they wanted to charge the highest price, whatever the market would bear, for their cheese, for their product. So what I see is a disparity between the consumer perception that, well, farmers are getting a lot of money because the cheese is so expensive, when in fact the opposite is true. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Mike?
So when we look at how milk is actually priced in this country, it's a very interesting process. We take the wholesale sales of product from the processor to the end user. Those are reported back to the USDA. The USDA publishes that data weekly, and then those prices across the weeks of a given month are put into a formula that then puts a value on butterfat, protein, and other solids in the milk. That then is distilled down and used in a formula to calculate what the value of milk price is. So the circle is such that the price of product drives the value of milk, and that sits inside of this federal order system that we use to define what the value of milk is. Now, what happens then at the retail level is a completely different discussion. And, you know, certainly there has been talk over time about, you know, how we could maybe capture some of that value, and is some of the value in product that's being realized at the retail level, you know, can we tap into that and pull it back to the farm gate level? Lots of those discussions have been had. That is certainly not materialized, but, you know, frankly, you can't necessarily have a runaway in product price without a correlating increase in farm price. Our challenge right now is that we're stuck with a bunch of inventory, and buyers just aren't in a place to continue to pay more for that product because there's an abundance of it out there. And frankly, processors have to work through that same problem. And as a result, it's put a drag on the milk price.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mike North with the Commodity Risk Management Group based in Platteville, looking at the challenges facing farmers, especially dairy farmers here in Wisconsin. Back to your calls. Hugo is with us in Marion. Hugo, hello.
Hello there.
What'd you want to bring up, Hugo?
Well, I'm a cheese salesman, and I used to be a dairy farmer, and I work for a small dairy up in Marion, Wisconsin, called DuPont Cheese. And I do a lot of the store promotions, and one of the things that I've really noticed over the years is the big influx of all the different flavored milks that are coconut milk and almond milk and cashew milk, hemp oatmeal, all these different milks, plus all the creamers, which actually doesn't have any dairy in it. That's what all the consumers are buying. The fluid milk used to be where the dairy farmer would get his money out of the extra money out of it. And I think that's just kind of fallen to the wayside now when we're competing against all these other ones. And they shouldn't even be called milk. I've never seen an almond milk.
Hugo, thanks for the call. Mike, is competition from non-dairy milks, I'll throw quotes around it for Hugo, hurting demand for dairy?
Well, it's certainly been a challenge, right? And if you look at the rules and regs at USDA, by the rules, these particular products should not be called milk, period. That's the rules. Milk comes from a lactating animal. That's the definition. And last time I checked, almonds are not lactating. The reality is, as we talk about these particular products, this is where it's important for the consumer to really dig in and understand what their products are made out of. And frankly, when we talk about milk, I agree, it should be, as it's defined by USDA, from a lactating animal. You know, really, as we go forward, it becomes a question of enforcement. Will the USDA do it? And there's been some bills that have been put forward to try to essentially bring enforcement to the rule. He's right. You know, if it says milk, it should be milk, and that's where there's an opportunity for milk to move back into that picture and service the need of the consumer. If the consumer wants a beverage that's made from a nut, that is fine, but we shouldn't mask the fact that the package says milk and inside the package there's no milk.
Thanks for the call, Hugo. Michelle joins us next in Dodgeville. Michelle, hello.
Hi. I had a question. Just wanted your guest feedback. I feel like dairy farmers don't have much bargaining power. Their input costs are dictated to them, and then their output is the prices for those things are also dictated to them. So I feel like farmers are kind of caught in the middle. So I was wondering if your guest could comment or have any insight on that.
What do you think, Mike?
Well, there's certainly some truth to that, in the sense that when we talk about inputs at the farm level, your largest one is feed, your second one is labor, and then there's overhead that comes with that. And in an environment where you can raise your own feed, you're going to pay the price of whatever fertilizer is and whatever the nutrients are for your crop. You're going to have to pay your labor whatever the going rate is. It's tough to find special deals there. On the flip side, with regard to revenue, there is a system in place that was put forward to help protect farmers with regard to the value of their milk, because it's not like grain. You know, with grain, you can put it in the bin and defer your sale till later, but milk is a perishable commodity, and if you don't have a buyer at that point, the risk of not having that buyer is greater than the risk of having a buyer that may not give you everything you want with regard to price. And so there's a balance that has to be struck there. Is it a challenge? Most certainly. And there's been a lot of debate as to how we arrive at the value of milk. Is the system that we have today still applicable? Do we need to go back and reevaluate, you know, what products are a part of that formulation as we look for value in butter, fat, and protein? And what does that translate to in a value for milk price? Certainly lots of those discussions, but when it comes to pay price, we have a system that was put forward in a very thoughtful manner to make sure that there was always a market for milk, because you can't just store the stuff. You can't put it in a bin and wait to sell it next spring. It's got to go to town today, and that requires a system that some will disagree with, but nonetheless a system that provides a market on a daily basis.
Thanks for that call. Briefly, Mike, as we wrap up, the size of farms that are filing for bankruptcy or going out of business, is there a sense that it's the smaller farms that are taking the biggest hits?
You know, I think there's a lot of those discussions and a lot of those thoughts, but it's shared by everyone. We're seeing larger farms leave, mid-sized farms leave, smaller farms leave. Everybody's situation is a bit unique, right? What kind of debt structure did they have when they came into it? What kind of facilities do they have? Have they been depreciated over time? Is there still value in them? You know, there's lots of different discussions, and it's not a size discussion. It's shared by all different sizes of producers. The bottom line here is that we have had low milk prices. We have had, you know, compressed and inverted profits at the farm level. And because Wisconsin has such a large dairy industry relative to some of our neighbors, we do stand out as having more of these bankruptcies of late as compared to some of the neighboring states, because the dairy industry has felt that pressure more than any other space in terms of different commodity producers.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks to Mike North, president and founder of the Platteville-based Community Risk Management Group, with us to talk about an increase in bankruptcy filings by farmers in Wisconsin in 2018. Coming up, we'll talk with a guest who has a theory for why so many serial killers were active from the 1960s to the late 90s. Not so much today. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The 1960s through 1980s is often referred to as the golden age of serial killers. Names like Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, Paul John Knowles, all active then. From 1980 to 1990 alone, the number of new serial killers in the United States was just under 700. While pop culture is still fascinated by their stories, from Netflix's Ted Bundy feature to true crime podcasts, we don't hear about active cases as much these days. Peter Vronsky is an investigative historian and former film and television documentary producer. He's the author of several books, including his latest, Sons of Cain, a history of serial killers from the Stone Age to the present. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, Peter, my teenagers were watching this Ted Bundy documentary about the serial killer, and it hit me, you know, when I was their age in the 80s, it seemed like we were hearing about serial killers all the time. Nowadays, it's not on the landscape. Is that just perception, or do the numbers back that up?
No, the numbers do back that up. Indeed, in those three decades between 1970 and 1999, 82% of 20th century American serial killers first made their appearance. And today, the number is significantly lower in terms of apprehensions now. Now, that also accompanies, of course, a dramatic decline in homicide and violent crimes overall since the 1990s. So that's, you know, that's one of the first factors that we're looking at.
When did we first develop this concept, this phrase, a serial killer?
Well, the term itself, serial killer, is introduced in around 1981. It begins to appear in the New York Times to describe the Atlanta child killer, Wayne Williams. We used other terms previously, recreational killers, just psychos, stranger on stranger killers, but just this notion of profiling them, identifying them, categorizing them, that is something that emerges in the 1980s, along with that term, serial killer, which, you know, all of us now know what that means. Prior to that, we used to see them as just each serial killing case as an individual aberration.
And there are a lot of different definitions that people use that overlap in different ways. What kind of key definition do you use as you focus on serial killers?
I use the current FBI definition because I think it fits the bill. And as of 2004, since the San Antonio Serial Murder Symposium, the FBI defines a serial killer as anyone who illegally kills two or more individuals in separate episodes with a cooling off period in between for any motive whatsoever.
And in your newest book, you focus on a particular subcategory of that. And I think that is what a lot of people think of when they think of serial killers, some sort of ritualistic or sexualized element. Can you talk, without going into too graphic detail, about that?
Well, exactly. You know, you have prophet serial killers. You have missionary serial killers. So you have all these different categories. But I think when, you know, we popularly think of a serial killer, we think of, you know, the John Wayne Gacy's and the Ted Bundy's indeed. And these are fantasy-driven sexual serial killers. You know, since Jack the Ripper, this has been a particular category of serial killer that just fascinate and horrify us.
Talking to Peter Vronsky, his new book is Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present, focusing on what's been called a golden age of serial killing, three decades or so from 1970 to 1999, and why there are fewer serial killers now. So let's get to that big question. Why this big peak in serial killers that rose and then fell?
Well, you know, serial killing often reflects what's happening in society. You know, it's not a coincidence that Jack the Ripper made his appearance in Whitechapel at that particular moment in the late 1880s. In the same way, there were factors in American society at that time. And you know, we often associate that serial killers are reflecting the time in which they're killing. But, you know, when you actually look at the evolution of a serial killer, they often, first of all, they make their first murder often when they're, you know, 27 to 28 years old. But their fantasies and their compulsions often begin to be formed as early as the age of five. So when we look at John Wayne Gacy, when we look at Ted Bundy, and the era in which they were killing, you need to back them up some 20, 25 years to when they were children, when they first began to fantasize about doing this. And of course, that takes us into the immediate post-World War II and Cold War eras from the late 1940s to the early 1960s. And in that period, there are two major factors that I suggest in my book, Sons of Cain, that, you know, came to play a major role. One, you had many men returning from the Second World War far more traumatized than we acknowledged at that time. You know, there was no diagnosis back then of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And so you have a generation now of traumatized men bringing up a generation of young boys. And so as I started looking at the fathers of some of those serial killers from that era, very often there is this description of kind of sullen, isolated men in silence raising their kids. So I think that's one factor. The other factor, I think you have these two genres of very popular culture that celebrates the abduction, restraint, torture, rape, and murder of women. The men's adventure magazines and the True Detective magazines, which always on their covers, right? They would portray a woman who's bound, her clothing disheveled, sometimes scratched and beaten, prepared to be raped and murdered. And she's looking off the magazine cover towards the buyer of the magazine, the message being that, you know, she could be had for the price of the magazine. And these magazines were not sold under the counter. They were sold in supermarkets, in drugstores, newsstands, along, you know, with Time, Newsweek, Life magazine, Ladies' Home Journal, Popular Mechanics. There was no stigma around these celebrations of rape at that time. So they shaped, I think, the fantasies of some of these, you know, damaged children that eventually, once they reach that age of 27 and 28, would you know, cross the line and commit their act. It's not a cause, but it's a number of factors coming together, you know, these perfect storms.
Peter, if we as a society didn't want to raise a new generation of serial killers, I assume we don't, based on your study of past serial killers, share some thoughts on how to prevent that in the future.
Well, you know, that's a question that's often asked, and I think it's a very utopian solution. We have to bring our children up in, you know, families that remain intact with you know, with love and care focused on the early period of a child's life. And again, that's a utopian thing. And that doesn't guarantee anything either. I'm at this moment interviewing a serial killer here in New Jersey who had that perfect childhood. His mom was there. His dad was there. They were raised in a middle-class family in this idealistic suburb. You know, he was in Little League, and yet he committed all these horrific, sadistic crimes, and there seems no explanation. So even that is not a guarantee.
We'll leave it there for now. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, anytime.
That's Peter Vronsky, investigative historian and a former film and television documentary producer. He's the author of several books, including his latest called Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present, talking about why there were so many serial killers relative today from about 1970 to 1999, why the numbers went up and then way back down. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. New legislation has been introduced at the state capitol that would provide some financial relief to Wisconsinites who serve as caregivers to a family member due to age or disability. If passed, the bipartisan bill would allow people to apply for state tax credits. Advocates see this as a first step to assist caregivers around the state. Our next guests are here to talk about the legislation and the impact it could have on families around Wisconsin. Helen Marks-Dix is the State Issues Advocacy Director for AARP Wisconsin. Helen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Senator Teston, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Helen, let's start with the big picture. What sorts of challenges do caregivers face around the state?
We have a lot of caregivers that are doing anything from simple tasks like household chores and taking people, helping them bathe, taking them to the grocery store, that type of thing, all the way up to caregivers that are doing major medical work, cleaning feeding tubes, taking care of people who are bedridden, and managing medications. So it's a wide range.
And I don't know if there's any way to measure this. Do we have an idea of roughly how many people are what we'd call caregivers?
We do. It's close to 600,000 here in Wisconsin, and their uncompensated care is valued at about $7 billion.
Wow. Now, Senator Teston, let's talk about what your legislation's looking to do here for caregivers.
Sure. We're looking to give a family home caregiver up to $1,000 tax credit for those who qualify they can't make more than $75,000 per year as a single filer, or more than $150,000 per year as joint filers. As Helen mentioned, we have close to 600,000 family home caregivers in the state of Wisconsin, and the amount of care that they provide is nothing short of $7 billion. And we want to be able to give people the opportunity to stay within their homes and to provide that quality of life, as opposed to going into a government-run or supported facility, which ultimately costs taxpayers money. And this isn't just about the dollars and cents. This is about really providing that quality of care and allowing people to stay within their homes, because it is not an easy task to take care of a loved one. I mean, the financial burdens, but also the emotional burden that it carries as well.
Now, you mentioned the financial limits, the caps there, and who would be eligible. What are some of the other eligibility factors? Who would be able to get this kind of support?
Sure. So the way we outline the legislation, this is similar, basically the same legislation that we introduced last session. So for those individuals who need help with one or more daily activities in their daily lives, or assistance in their own daily functions, we want to be able to make sure that that support's there for these individuals.
And studies by AARP show that the average family caregiver is spending $7,000 out of pocket. And that doesn't make up for, you know, lost time from work or money they don't put in the pension plans or other ways they financially disservice themselves trying to take care of someone.
Right. So, Helen, I want to talk a little more about that. Senator Tessin mentioned it wasn't just dollars and cents, but that's a big part of it. You mentioned, okay, we're spending out of pocket to provide care for a relative, but also probably that means I'm not going to work as much. I'm having to take time away. So it's kind of getting me on both ends if I'm a caregiver.
That's true, you know, and it's incredible that the average caregiver spends 18 hours a week doing some kinds of cares, and one out of four workers actually has some kind of caregiving responsibility. So it really does hit the workplace, and it hits your daily finances in a way most people don't realize.
And Senator Tessin, I know this is something that affects people around the state. Have you heard about this from constituents in central Wisconsin?
Oh, absolutely, and around the state for that matter. So last session, I chaired the Workforce Development, Military Affairs, and Senior Issues Committee, and that was one of the reasons why we championed this bill with Representative Skowronski, who's my assembly author again this session in the assembly. Part of it, too, is that when you take a look at our state's demographics, we have an aging population in the state of Wisconsin. In fact, our population that is 65 or older is set to increase by 72% by 2040. We are going to have counties in the state of Wisconsin that their population that's 65 or older is 10% or more. For instance, in places like Monroe County, which I represent, that population that's 65 or older are set to increase by 75%. And we have some counties in the state that you're going to see that increase over 104%. And so we really need to be proactive on how we address this demographic challenges, because it will put a strain on our healthcare system. And if we can have people stay within their homes and have that quality of life, as opposed to going into, like I mentioned before, a state-run facility, I think ultimately that is going to save taxpayers a lot more money down the road if we can put a little bit of money, invest the money up front.
We're talking to Senator Patrick Tessin, a Republican from the Stevens Point area, and Helen Marks-Dix, State Issues Advocacy Director for AARP Wisconsin, looking at legislation that would provide tax credits for people providing care in Wisconsin. Helen, you wanted to jump in and say something, I think.
Well, I was just saying that all our surveys of our members show that people want to stay in their homes. And to Pat's argument about how the population is aging, it's worth noting that many of the people that are caring for the elderly are spouses and other elderly people themselves.
They're aging too. And Senator Tessin, to get a little procedural here, this is a tax credit, not a tax deduction. Cool. I have to sit and think about what the difference is. Can you explain that a little bit?
So essentially, when the people take advantage of this, at the end of the year, when they file their taxes, they'll get a credit for their caregiving services. So, that's basically how we break it down. We think it's a clean and easy way to do it, and we think it's the most appropriate way to help these individuals for these home caregivers.
Helen, how much of a difference do you see this making for caregivers who are eligible?
I think for caregivers who are eligible, it's nice to get the money. And it isn't a great deal of money, you know, compared to what they're spending. But I also think it's very important that we recognize them and recognize that this is a value not only to their families, but to society as a whole. Because people just kind of become caregivers by default, and they don't realize how they really make the system work. There's nobody else to step forward. We don't have lots of people in the long-term care system. We don't have insurance that covers this. We don't have government programs that covers this. So it's the heroic people and the families that step up. And it's just nice to recognize them in some way and take a step in the right direction of saying there's value to what you do for all of us, that you do it for your family.
Are there more ways we could be doing that, providing that kind of emotional support for people providing care? Because it's got to feel isolating. I'm in this by myself, but I'm doing the same thing as a lot of people. What can we do to provide that kind of support?
Well, there's all kinds of ways you can provide support. And, you know, there's going to be a package of bills coming later on, and we'll come back and talk about them. But also, you know, most of the communities have support groups. People can volunteer to help people who are caregiving just by doing things like shopping or saying, I'll stay with the person who needs care. Will you go out and get your nails done or, you know, just get out of the house? And it's all those little things in recognition, volunteering to just be helpful and acknowledging that caregiving's a hard chore.
Senator Tustin, a similar bill has been introduced in the past. It didn't end up clearing the legislature. Why is that? And what are your hopes for it making it through this time?
So I think one of the biggest challenges that we faced when we introduced this legislation is that when we got the fiscal estimate back, it was pretty high. It was $179 million. And I think some of our colleagues in the legislature got sticker shock. I'm hopeful that this session we will get a better fiscal estimate and hopefully one that shows the potential cost savings that we're going to see, especially particularly within the Medicaid budget, that I think we should be able to get more support. And especially now, we introduced that legislation late last session, and by doing it now, early on in the session, I think we're going to have more time to build support, and we have a broad coalition of individuals who came down to the Capitol when we released this bill last week. So I'm optimistic. I know Helen's been great with AARP, and we've had a number of other organizations like the Alzheimer's Association. They've been very active in this. So I'm confident. I'm really hopeful that we can get this through, and if it's either incorporated into the budget or as standalone legislation, I'm hoping we can get the support of the legislature and Governor Evers.
I think timing makes a difference. At the end of the session, we've kind of spent all our money. Now we're at the point where we have that pot of money and we're looking how to spend it. And this, it seems to me, should rise to the top of the list.
And Helen, you teased that there might be more legislation on the way. Can you tell us a little bit about what you expect to see?
Well, I'm hoping to see the CARE Act introduced, which is training and education for caregivers when somebody leaves the hospital so that they're not stressed by trying to do medical chores that are beyond their capacity or they don't have the confidence to do. There's probably going to be a talk of money for respite care again, which has been in the past. So I think we're going to look at some of the things that we have tried to do in previous sessions and see what percolates to the top is worth doing and worth repeating and work with the senator and others to get these done.
And Senator Tustin, a lot of times when we talk about the legislature and the governor, we look at the points of conflict, disagreement between the parties. You've got bipartisan support on this one. Is this something that you see people working across the aisle on?
I think so. I think this is a no-brainer in many respects, and we are going to have ample opportunity to have our political fights and battles over the course of the next few months. But my approach has always been, let's find that common ground first. Let's build off of that. And I think this is one of those areas that it transcends political parties, because we all know, whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, or conservative, we all know individuals who can benefit from this. And so that's why I'm confident we will get this done this session.
And Helen, before I let you two go, if there's somebody out there listening right now thinking, I'm a caregiver, I'm feeling overwhelmed, this sounds lovely, but I can't wait for this, what kind of resources out there? Where are places they can reach out to find out what helps out there?
I would go to your Aging and Disability Resource Center, which each county has one of those, and you can call them up and say, I'm looking for support, I'm looking for caregiver support, I'm looking for help. And in many of those Aging and Disability Resource Centers, they have dementia care specialists who specialize in people with dementia care, but there are all other kinds of support groups, and that would be the place I would start. And that's regardless of age of either yourself or the person you're taking care of.
Helen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Senator Tustin, thanks for coming over.
Happy to be on.
We've been talking to Helen Marks Dix, State Issues Advocacy Director for AARP Wisconsin. Also with us there, Senator Patrick Tustin, Republican representing Wisconsin's 24th State Senate District that includes Stevens Point. They join us today to talk about new proposed legislation that would provide tax credits to qualified caregivers in Wisconsin. That's people who are providing care for seniors or maybe people with disabilities in their families. The goal to help defray some of the costs of providing that care and that might be lost due to not being able to go to a job. Got an email from a listener named Kurt I want to share. Kurt says, greetings from Footville, Wisconsin. Kurt says, I heard the short monotribe, that's a monologue and a diatribe, I love that word, about Starbucks workers complaining about having to listen to the Hamilton soundtrack, plus your take, Rob, on Christmas music, and I felt obligated to chime in. Here's Kurt's story. In the mid-1970s, I was a bartender and manager for an Italian restaurant in Saratoga Springs, New York. At that time, if you weren't running a disco, your music source was a jukebox with 145s. So it's 200 songs, in case you don't remember. Kurt worked 5 nights a week from 6 p.m. to 4:30 a.m. In October of 75, Queen released Bohemian Rhapsody from the album A Night at the Opera. I had to listen to this 6.5-minute tome of a song about 10 times a night for the better part of 1976. Kurt goes on, jukeboxes worked a lot like iTunes does. It would keep track of how many times a single got played. If it got played a lot, it stayed on the box forever. There were other songs, but think about how many times Bohemian Rhapsody got re-released. I'm sure you could wiki it, but I'd bet a couple dollars it's been at least 3 times. Kurt says, I don't care if the movie was the best thing since sliced pork. I don't care if I ever hear the song again. Thanks for letting me vent. Kurt, a little music to go out here. In honor of you, it's not Bohemian Rhapsody. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.